Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today I'm going to continue discussing cover story. That idea about ourselves which we developed so very long ago, early in our childhood, and then put on us like a dress or a disguise or a cover story, like a spy, and then come to believe that it's the whole story about us, and then spend our life confirming it even when it's not the whole truth and other things about us would be better to demonstrate. Okay, enough of that. I'm going to talk about that in the show, and then I'm going to play two interviews with two mystery writers. Really, really interesting guys. So hang on. Here comes the show. The Lynn Show, which is today being brought to you by Asheville Hot Air Balloons in Asheville, North Carolina. Are you overwhelmed by all the unexpected things that are happening in our world? As a therapist, I know that one of the best ways to deal with difficult problems is sometimes just to take a break from them. And there is no better break than getting up above it all in a hot air balloon. Your burdens will lift, your perspective will change, and you'll feel liberated. It's fun, it's therapeutic, and it's cheaper than therapy. Tell them that you heard about Asheville Hot Air Balloons on The Lynn Show, and contact Asheville Hot Air Balloons either at their website, AshevilleHotAirBalloons.com, or call them at 828-667-9943. That's 828-667-9943. Hello, and this is The Lynn Show, and welcome. If you're a new listener and you're only just beginning to understand that this show is about becoming who you really are, figuring out what might be standing between you and the things you want to be or do, or standing between you and the things you want to stop being and stop doing, and that is connected in some ways to who you really are, and that you might be acting in your life in a way that only demonstrates a part of you and not the whole of you. So in this show, using the information that I have gained over my 30 plus years as a psychotherapist, not to mention the many more than that years of living, I'm talking about what stops us from being who we really are, stops us from doing what we want to do, keeps us from stopping what we want to stop. And in the first half of the show, I talk about those things, the obstacles that get in our way. So many of us think, and I hear this in my practice over and over, well, I can't do that because that's just not me, or I do that because that's just who I am. And we have this idea that the way we act, even the way we think about ourselves, those things that we identify ourselves as, they are the limit. But I know, because I've seen over and over again, people hiding parts of themselves that are very, very real, but that their unconscious has figured out a way to keep a secret. That, the secret part, I call our undercover, and I will be talking about that in the weeks to come. But what I've been talking about for the last few weeks is what I call our cover story. Our cover story is the stuff we show, the stuff we demonstrate, the way we quite often think about ourselves, and so it's the limit of what we think we can express. And how did that cover story come to be? Well, that's what I've been talking about for the last few weeks. And if you haven't heard the show before, and you want to learn more about the cover story, about how families are balanced, about how to figure out what your role in the family might be, you can go to my website, thelynnshow.com. That's thelynnshow. And there, if you click on podcasts, there will be the list of all the shows I've done and the little blurbs that tell you what I'm talking about in those shows and who I interview. And interviews are the other part of my show. In the second half of my show, I interview people who make their living or their life with their art, because they are the people who, at least in that area of their life, are who they really are. And you will hear in the first interview a man who is so who he is as a writer that it's exploding out of him. And you will hear how much I love to hear it. That clear attachment to that part of oneself is why I do what I do with my life. So, before we get to those interviews, I'm going to talk a little bit more about covers. Last time I was telling you that once you've decided on a cover, once it becomes the way that you think about yourself, it's the way you present yourself to the world. Without saying a word, you announce to the world that you're brave, or you're a coward, or you're to be paid attention to, or you're to be ignored, or you're going to be the saver, or you're the one who needs to be saved. And as I said last time, you're either the bully or the victim, or maybe you're the audience, or maybe you're the star. You certainly have known people who do that. They walk into a room, and you just know that they expect to be paid attention to. And on the other hand, you know people who continually put themselves in the victim role, see themselves as a victim, even when that isn't actually happening. And that's because your cover, what you tell yourself about yourself, is so convincing that you act as if it were true, even when it clearly isn't. For example, if you have a cover that says, "I try, but I don't succeed," then even though you have the ability to succeed, you rarely do. So, created while we were very, very young, our cover story is the hallmark of our adult personality. If your parents were clearly inadequate to the task of raising a child, or your childhood contained neglect or abandonment, trauma, or even abuse, then you can easily understand why you would have to adopt a cover. But sometimes there are situations in which children misunderstand their parents' intentions, or things happen that nobody can have intended, and covers are developed where none were necessary. So that children whose parents are ill or who die or go off to fight in wars quite often have abandonment covers. I am expendable. I will be left. I am not valuable. I am not essential. Certainly you know people. Maybe even this is true for you. So through no fault of anybody's, not because a parent wanted to abandon a child, the child believes that they are abandonable and presents that in the world, sees that where it isn't, and even can help to cause that to happen, to confirm the cover, which is what we believe about ourselves. These things can be called circumstantial covers. Misunderstandings, circumstances, accidents, events that are no one's fault can cause you to create a cover. I had a client named Sally, and she misunderstood her parents' intentions, and that misunderstanding demonstrates this unfortunate phenomenon. When Sally was 4 years old, her parents were afraid that she was too thin, so they took her to a doctor to fatten her up. Sally decided that her parents didn't want a thin daughter, so she gave them what she thought they wanted. At 40, Sally is still struggling with a lifelong weight problem. Circumstantial covers can be very confusing to the people who have them, because sometimes what they believe about themselves, their cover, isn't based on events that actually happened directly to them. Why should I be so scared? Some people say, my parents were always kind to me. I see a lot of younger children in my practice, that is, children who had older siblings. And these children quite often adopt a good or quiet, passive or scared cover after watching the punishment of an older child who had a bad, difficult, or rebellious cover. Older children sometimes adopt the expendable, left out, or unimportant cover when a sibling born too close behind them captures the attention they needed to feel important or special or valuable. As I was saying, I quite often see younger children who are very timid, shy, frightened, apprehensive, anxious, and, you know, they report that they didn't have unpleasant childhoods. Nothing bad ever happened to them. And quite often I find in these families that there's an older child who either got labeled, lumbered with the rebellious bad kid cover, and therefore came in for a lot of punishment, criticism, even, you know, abusive behavior. And the younger child, observing this, got scared, not because of anything that had happened directly to them. Or I have a client who had a rageaholic father, and this father was particularly abusive to her, as she was the oldest child. And she decided quite young that she had to take this, she had to be a lightning rod for this behavior in order to protect her younger siblings and her mother from her father's rage. And so she developed a cover as the one who gets treated badly. She developed that, and her younger siblings developed the apprehensive, scared, anxious cover. You can see that what happens in your childhood, whether it's intentional or not, leads you to develop your cover, and that cover colors how you see the world, what you expect, and therefore what you see, even if it isn't there. Circumstantial covers can be very difficult to recognize and take seriously, but covers created in a no-fault situation are just as debilitating as those built on solid fact. Without meaning to, a parent who gets sick or leaves to fight in a war can saddle a child, as I said, with an abandonment cover. Although the parent didn't want to leave them, the children who are left think of themselves as leavable. People who have circumstantial covers are in a double bind. When their lives stop working or when they hurt, they sometimes can't take their pain seriously because they can't see where it originated. I had a very good childhood, they often say. My parents loved me. suffering from anxiety or depression, they come into therapy for help. But quite often, when they're confronted by the idea of the cover that is clearly driving them, they back off and leave therapy. They are unwilling to hold a parent who obviously loved them responsible for their adoption of a negative cover. So, again, are you thinking about how you present to the world? Are you thinking about what went on in your childhood? Whether intended, accidental, circumstantial, or intentional? I was saying last week that parents who are basically insecure themselves may encourage their children to behave in dependent ways so that the parent can feel big and strong. You know, it's pretty heady stuff, pretty powerful stuff, a dependent child. It needs you for everything. And so a parent who is insecure themselves can really get off on that and without meaning to discourage the development of the child into an independent human being. So a child who's been encouraged to stay dependent has a dependent cover story. I need to be cared for. Even though left to its natural devices, this child would have grown up to be quite independent. And again, I am going to talk about the stuff that we keep undercover, the stuff that we hide even from ourselves, and which is quite often what we need when we get stuck. I'm going to talk about that in a couple of weeks, but I'm not done with the cover story yet. So if you're interested in learning more about cover story as an idea, and maybe your own cover story, stay tuned. I'll be talking about that in the weeks to come. But now, after a slight musical interlude, you know, I haven't said this in a long time, but the song that I play at the beginning of the show and the song that I play at the end and the song I'm going to play now for our musical interlude are off my CD. I haven't said this in, God, I don't remember the last time. Anyway, this is my CD. It's called I Won't Go With a Whimper, which is the song that closes the show. And if you're at all interested in that, that's up there on my website too, thelinshow.com. But here, the song I play as a musical interlude for the show, it's called Behind the Woman, There's a Child. And after that will be my interview with James McComber. And then following that, my interview with Don Bruns. So here they are.
I can work the whole damn day, way into the night. Look like I don't need to play. I make out all right.
This is Jim, say it for
McComber.
Me again. McComber. You know, I wasn't going to get it.
Yeah, okay.
This is Jim McComber.
Yes.
You've been saying it all your life, so it's easy for you.
It's true.
Yes.
And my father before me.
That's right, right. Who always called himself by his name?
Actually, no, Mac.
Mac.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what?
Even my mother called him Mac half the time. So.
Do you know what's funny about that is that my father was called Mac as well.
Oh.
And his name was Meyer.
Okay.
And I think in the service, oh no, I don't remember.
Right.
Anyway, they called him Mac, right? And so from very divergent backgrounds, we had the same nicknamed fathers.
Amazing.
It really is. Okay, so I don't know, Jim.
Okay.
And so I'm going to just learn now.
All right.
I do this radio show, and I do a series called Anatomy of an Artist, and I like to interview people who make their living or their life with their art.
Okay.
And writers, of course, are people like that. So I'm assuming that that is true for you.
Well, I guess I have to leave it to other people to judge whether it's art or not, but it's a creative endeavor for certain. And
let me ask you, how did it happen to you? How did you find it?
Well, like half the people who are writers now, I used to be a lawyer. I'm a recovering lawyer, as they say.
What kind?
It was general practice, but mostly real estate towards the end.
Here?
No, in New England.
Uh-huh.
I never practiced down here. I moved here in 93, had every intention of taking the Florida bar. It used to be in the old days, if you were a lawyer in one state, you could just move.
Yeah, no,
you have to take. So I put it off, and I didn't really want to do it, put it off, and I guess a couple of years went by, and I just was like, you know what? I just don't want to do it anymore. I didn't want to do it anymore anyway. But
did you want to do it when you were doing it?
To begin with. But a lot of the negative things you hear about lawyers are true. there are plenty of very decent human beings who are lawyers too. I mean, there really are.
Disclaimer.
Yeah. But I just met too many. By the time I had gone about 15, 16 years into the profession, I had just met too many
Sharks.
Who I didn't like.
Yeah.
And I caught myself a couple of times being a bit of a bully, which I didn't like. I don't like bullies, and though I don't want to be a bully.
Are you saying that the thing required it, or you thought it required it, or did it brought it out of you?
I think to a certain extent it does require it. How can you represent other people if you're not willing to really, you know, try and push the other side around a little bit? So that part of it was there. But the other part too is just it's almost a persona you start to adapt. I'm a reasonably decent sized human being,
yes,
but I would see these little 5'2" nerds running around acting like they were going to just kick butt every time. You would just look at them and say, "Squash you!"
Right?
So anyway, but mostly I just I really was just tired of it. And here we were down here in paradise. I mean, I just love it down here. And so after a while sitting around, my wife said to me, "Why don't you write that book you always wanted to write?"
Uh-huh.
So somebody once asked me, "Well, why did you always want to write a book?" And that one stumped me. I have no idea. I just, you know, just really always did. I remember back in the 70s, before I even went to law school, I started sitting at this old clacky typewriter that my mother had. I mean, the real kind where, you have to take a wind-up to hit the keys, you know, and slam it down just to make them go. And nothing came of it. I wrote some stuff, not much at all, and just I wasn't the most ambitious person in the world. But I've always been a voracious reader. And credit to my mother. I mean, she had me in the Fall River Public Library. Fall River, Mass. Is where I grew up. I think when I was like 2 or 3 years old. And I just, even as a kid, I was, you know, as a regular kid, I played sports and everything else. But boy, did I love to go to the library too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was just as happy. And I've said many times, my sister's a librarian. And I've said many times that if I weren't doing the things I had done over, you know, I would be so happy to do a bookstore or be in a library. I just really enjoy books.
I understand that one.
Yeah.
I can't. Just go in there. It just feels good to be in there.
It does. Libraries, too. I mean, just to go to the library just to relax.
Mm-hmm.
Just sit down and, well, I can't just sit. I have to go look and see what's in the new books and everything else. But so anyway, I decided to write the book, and I sat down. I had no idea what I wanted to write about. It probably was inevitable that I would want to write thrillers simply because I really love to read thrillers. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do read a lot of other things, too. I read probably second to thrillers, histories. I'm a history buff. Particularly British history, and so someday I may write something about some spy in the court of Henry VIII or something like that, though that's been done by a couple of people already. But I did have this opening scene for a book in my head, and so I had no idea what the plot was going to be, what the story was going to be, what anything was going to be, and I wrote the first scene, and I thought, okay, well, that's happened. This should happen now. And I worked it out in increments as I went along. And I had given myself about a year to see if I could actually write a whole book. It was I don't know if intimidating is the right word, but
it's a challenge.
I had set a challenge for myself. And it took about 8 months. And it was fun. I had the time of my life.
Yeah.
And when it was done, start letting other people read it, you know, first of all your relatives. But I knew relatives are going to be inclined to say nice things. So I wanted to get it to strangers. So Deb Stowell's name comes up in the woman who owns Circle Books here in Sarasota. Gave it to her. She gave it to one of her readers. They liked it. Really, it's pretty much how it got started. Strangers said lots of good things about it. So that was like, huh. You know, up to that point, I would write something and I would read it back to myself and think, yeah, that sounds like something a writer would write. Yeah. I mean, I had no idea what style I was going to do. Though I did have an English major, I mean, and I did, had read enough people. But I didn't start out to try and imitate anybody. Plot-wise, I loved early Clancy, so I knew I was going to try and have a complex plot, maybe even two or three that come together at the end, that sort of thing. Love to travel, love international stuff, so naturally the central character is a lawyer.
You write what you know.
But at least I started out, he was a lawyer who wasn't practicing law, he was a lawyer on sabbatical in a southern university. And I had been in Germany in the Air Force for 3 years, so I wanted to have a parallel plot, and I did want to set it in other parts of the world other than the United States, or both. I wanted to split it up between the two. So, you know, one thing led to another, and I just, you know, brought that plot out. So after the first book, which is Bargain for Exchange, I should give the names of my books.
Yes, good idea.
Bargain for Exchange, which is actually in American law a synonym for contract. Okay, all the titles of my books are legal terms.
Oh,
they don't
fair.
Have to be, but it's just like a gimmick. And so there was this one author who was with Tor Books, I guess, and I didn't know him, but my brother-in-law knew him, and he gave him that first book, and he said, this is really good. Can you write another? Do you think you could write another one? So I said, well, you know, let me give it a try. So I wrote the second book before the first one even got published. And so I had that one, and that was titled Art and Part, which is a Scottish legal term. And the background, by now I had made the central focus of the books a firm of international lawyers in Washington with ties to the intelligence community.
Uh-huh.
So the central character, he had gotten out of high school, going into the Army, going into the Green Berets, done special operations, you know, CIA. So he had this background, and as part of his cover, how he became a lawyer, part of his cover, they sent him to law school. Because when they establish a cover in these agencies, they really do establish a cover. I mean, for 3 years, they send people to law school. They go out, you know, they're missing for a week or two every now and then because they're still on active duty or still on call. But
is this true?
Yes. So that's how he became. So this head of this law firm that's with close ties to the intelligence community comes across this guy and brings him into his firm, and it goes on from there. So at this point in his life, he's a little bit older.
So do they know who he is?
Oh, yeah. The law firm was established by two OSS veterans after World War II.
Right.
So it's
a repository, essentially.
Pretty much. I forget how I phrase it in several of the books, but it's just many of the associates are more than lawyers.
Yeah.
But they are all really lawyers.
Right.
But they've just been brought. For example, in the third book, A Grave Breach, I introduced a new character as a female, and I wanted her to be just as tough and strong as everybody. I wanted her to be beautiful and smart and everything, but just as tough and strong. But I wasn't going to do Special Forces Green Berets again. Besides, back in the 60s and 70s, there weren't any women in the Green Berets anyway, so it really wouldn't ring true. So I had her go through the Justice Department thing, into a small law school, into Justice Department. Mm-hmm. They have special training. The FBI hostage rescue team is the rival of any special forces unit in certain situations anyway. So she's there, and ended up, again, working things out as I go along. Yeah. She really ended up being the hero, the complete hero of the third book. She's the one who saves John Cann as the central character that I talked about. He gets in trouble. She's the one that saves him. She goes over to Europe and kicks butt.
Oh, good. We love this.
Yeah. Oh, I get so many good research. I wanted people to really like the character. Mm-hmm. And by the time it was done, I loved it. I have such a crush on her. And, I've had many reviewers and many female reviewers especially saying, oh, give us more Catherine. You got to bring Catherine back.
Right.
The other thing I also heard from the third book was, you got to get John and Catherine together.
Ah, yeah, you know, right, of course, right.
Yeah. So if anybody's listening, they do get together in the next book.
I want to respond to this. I just want to say that I don't know what you did, what kind of a lawyer you were, but there's tremendous passion in what you feel about your writing.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. In fact, I'll even say to a certain extent, if I had to write the first one again, probably I would be a little, or not write it again if I got a chance to edit it. I get a little preachy from time to time in that one. Got some things off my chest, yeah. I'd say. Not so much in the latter books, though. I think, you know, there's a certain perspective in there. Hopefully, you know, it's the good should triumph over evil sort of things, you know.
This is why we write, and this is why we read mysteries. Right.
And also one of the things I wanted about the characters that I put in is they're, especially the first one, I'm trying to think about the other two to a certain extent, to a lesser extent, but the first one particularly is about retribution, and I really just was very tired of even Jack Ryan. And again, far be it from me to criticize John. It's not even a criticism, Tom Clancy. I mean, but even Jack Ryan, his hero, Tom Clancy's hero, would take it to a certain point, and then have this. What's that? Come by a moment where, oh, I can't sink to their level. I can't do those things. You know? And I wanted a guy who was really a good, decent human being, but
sinks
if
to the
bad guys, the bad things should happen to bad guys. It's that simple. So I wish it were that simple.
Yes.
But anyway.
But I'm going to say it again. This is the reason that we write, and this is the reason that we read mysteries.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't happen often enough in our real life, and all of us want it.
Yeah. And I think, I really do, and the reaction I've gotten from the books is I do think that people, I've gotten some, not a lot, some negative, that was cruel, the book is brutal. I've read plenty of books that are far more graphic than the stuff I write, but there are some ugly things, especially in the first book, well, in all of them, I guess, that happen. First book is about terrorists who severely, it's a parallel plot to something else, but I mentioned before, this guy goes to be a, he's on sabbatical in a southern university, and this young lady does something stupid, and the university wants to discipline her, so she has entitled to, you know, have somebody represent her at the disciplinary hearing. So, one thing, you know, he knows somebody there, and they, you know, ask him to represent her, and the bad guys, who are a support network for the middle, I'm jumping around a little bit. The Sami Alarian business down here?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yes,
that was what gave me the idea. I thought, what about if they had a network of terrorist support groups in universities? Okay, so now the bad guys who know of John because of his background in counterterrorism, grab her and do horrible things to her.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
And really, basically, the second half of the book is John Kahn hunting them
making
down.
Making it even.
Hunting
right.
them down, yeah. I probably don't want to give one of my favorite sentences. And I've used it both in the third book and in a fourth manuscript that I just finished, where somebody's talking about that to him, and they say they never found the people
who did that
to Janie, meaning no one was ever tried and convicted.
Right.
And Kahn answers simply, no, they never found them.
Yeah.
Like, right. That's one of those sentences where I go, ooh, I
got it.
Yeah. Meaning, so, and I said, he meant something entirely different.
So, and this, what you just did, That is so writer, you know, and I so love it I haven't seen it a lot in the other people that I have been interviewing. It's kind of interesting. That excitement about saying something, mm-hmm. the way you say it, the language, the attachment to the work. I haven't seen a whole hell of a lot of that in other people I've interviewed, forgive me, but it's lovely to see, and I really,
I've said many times, too, I mean, you're sitting at the never I know a laptop, mm-hmm. and you're sitting there, and you're typing along, and you get into the book to a certain extent, and I've had several instances where the words are screen before
they're in your brain. I know.
And then you go, wow, that's good.
I know.
And then you dive back in, you're ready to go.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful to hear you saying this, because I write too, so I know that one, and I know it's you and the thing.
It's a wonderful feeling. It really is. It's I don't want to get graphic here, but I mean, it's not as good as sex or anything, but
it depends.
It's a lesser degree.
but I think the truth is that it's the same thing in the sense that when sex is good, you have given yourself to it. And that's what happens with the work, is that there's no separation. You know, the I can't think of what the actual word I want is. But you lose the boundaries blur.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what happens.
Well, don't make us sound psychotic now.
Boundaries
don't blur.
Well, no.
Don't blur to the extent that we can't come back when we want.
Not to worry. I'm a psychotherapist, and I'll take care of it.
All right.
But I don't think that that's psychotic. I think that's what creativity is.
Yeah,
You know, and I think that as a culture, we're much too interested in boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
and rigidity, yeah. And that we're too afraid, really, mm-hmm. of blurring that, and that is what allows a lot of creativity to happen. Is that you're not paying attention to what's right and wrong and good and bad, mm-hmm. and all that. You're in it, you know.
Yeah.
And I see it so clearly in you, and it's just lovely to see.
Oh, good. Thank you.
Well, okay. So I'd like to ask. I know the.
Oh, you saw me peeking at my wife.
Look, we have to get to it.
If we didn't have a cocktail party, I would talk for
We could talk all night, right.
You haven't seen the writers at this conference, have you? There's not going to be any liquor left if we don't hurry down there.
Okay, then. I like to ask, is there anything I haven't asked you that I should have, do you want to say anything about what it feels like to make a life as an artist?
Not much about the latter part. I mean, yes, it feels good, but I love reading. I love writing. If you ever see me on some, you know, on I was going to say Johnny Carson, showing my age, but it's a late night talk show complaining about having slaved away in a garret. It isn't. It has its moments of frustration and difficulty, mm-hmm. but for the most part, it's a great way to do it. And it's one of those things you heard so many people say so many times. I would do this for nothing.
And everybody
I did. In fact, for a long time.
Yeah,
every writer has done it for nothing.
It's not only the writers. I interview musicians and artists and painters and actors.
Oh, wait a minute. Can we take that out of the tape?
Yes.
I don't want the publisher to hear that I would do it for nothing.
I can. I'll edit it out.
No, that's all
right. But the truth is...
I'll tell them I was drunk. I'll tell them I'd already been to the cocktail party.
I think the truth is that it is the people who do it because they have to do it,
mm-hmm.
that are the
mm-hmm.
real artists.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't so much that you would do it for nothing. It is that it's what you...
It's its own reward.
It's its own reward. That's exactly right.
Money, yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And that for real artists, that's what it's about. Yeah. It's the doing it that's the reward.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you, Jane.
Well, the only other thing I want to do is give the exact names of the book.
Please
Bargained,
do.
Past tense, for exchange, is the first one. Art and Part. Is the second. A Grave Breach is the third. I don't have a specific publication date, but Sovereign Order is the fourth manuscript.
Will be coming out in
will
some
become someday at some point. And
is it all the same publisher?
No, it's been two of one of another one, and Sovereign Order remains to be seen.
Okay, all right. Well...
And I have a website, too.
Oh, please.
With my name, jamesmacomber.com.
Spell it.
jamesmacomber.com. Yep.
Check him out. Read his books.
Yep.
Thank you very much,
Thank
Jill.
You.
And that was James Macomber. And as you heard, it's so wonderful for me when I talk to somebody who is so immersed in the work. Remember, the whole thrust of this show is about being who you are. Lots of us do jobs that we don't think of as us. You know, you're I don't want to name any profession because in any given profession, there can be people who are truly identified with that profession. I mean, for example, if you're a waitress in L.A. or New York, the chances are you're not particularly attached to that. You're doing it because it's something to make a living and you do something else. But I have had waitresses everywhere who are identified with their job and love it. So it's this thing of being who you are. And I don't know who James was as a lawyer, but as a writer, it is clearly who he is. And the excitement and the attachment and the delight, you know, he has a crush on his character. He's so involved with it. It is very definitely a large part of who he is. And that's what this show is all about. Helping all of us become closer and closer and closer to who we really are. So that interview is particularly special to me because it's clear that that is who he is. And No, the next interview I'm going to do is with Don Bruns, and he is many things. As you'll hear, I discover, as the interview progresses, all of the things that he's done, all of the talents that he has, all of the ways in which he has expressed his creativity and his ideas about what success is about. So, here now is my interview with mystery writer Don Bruns.
So, I'm sitting here with Don Bruns at the Mystery Writers Convention in Sarasota, Florida.
Yeah, it's called a conference to die for.
The conference to die for. You're the only person who thought to mention that.
I think that's the name of it.
I think you're right. I think
and we've been doing it 5 years, and I come every year, but I never know.
Is it always called that?
Yes. Yes. Pretty sure.
So
I could be wrong.
You couldn't be wrong.
But I don't know.
Not about this.
I could be wrong.
So this is Don Bruns, and he's a mystery writer. And what I always ask people, what I always want to know, because as you know, I interview people who make their living or their life with their art, whatever it is. And what I always want to know is, how did it find you, or how did you find it? How did it happen to you? What made you know that you wanted to write?
I grew up reading the Hardy Boys when I first could really read, you know, something that I wanted to read, and the Hardy Boys were the first thing I remember. And it was the two brothers solving crimes, and I just thought they were great. And then I quickly graduated to a series called Ken Holt that was more, a little more sophisticated than the Hardy Boys, and just found that that was just a passion for the crime writing. And when I was 12, I wrote a short story and sent it to Alfred Hitchcock Magazine. They promptly sent it back.
What did they say?
It was a standard form letter that said, you know,
thank you very much.
This does not meet our criteria at the time or whatever. So, but I was hooked, and I realized that I actually got a real rejection letter. And
you were already a real writer.
Yeah. So then got out of college and went on the road as a comic with another guy. And we did 7 years on the road. We did Playboy clubs. We did Vegas. We did...
Okay, hold on a second. I missed something. You were 12, and you were interested and attracted to writing.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're 21?
Yeah, and... as a musician now, and I'm on the road.
So you also got interested in music?
I majored in music.
You majored in music.
Yeah.
What do you play?
I played guitar on the road. I played woodwinds. That was my major.
And do you remember how you got interested in music?
My third grade, you could join a band and learn an instrument. So my parents decided I would do that, and so I did.
And you learned woodwinds?
Mm-hmm. Clarinet.
Clarinet? So, okay, so we got lots of arts here.
But I went on the road, and we wrote our routines for 8 years.
And you played guitar?
Yeah, and we did funny songs, and we did little bits with the audiences and things like that. And so it became this very intense thing where you had to constantly write and revise. And when you got to do it in front of an audience. So
you got feedback.
You got immediate feedback. You saw what worked. So then when I got out of there, I started an advertising agency and wrote advertising copy, which, again, is wonderful training for a writer because you take 300 pages of material, you boil it down to 30 seconds, and you keep the pizzazz, the fun, and the romance, and the message clean,
yeah.
and you learn how to edit just and get to the
just
essence.
Just what's essential, right.
The essence, and still make it exciting.
So and, you've been writing, essentially,
oh, yeah,
all my life.
All my life. And then... decided I had to take it to the novel about 11 years ago, take it to the long form, novel form. So I did.
Did you stop running the agency?
No, the agency still exists. It's up in Ohio, and I live down here now, so it takes care of itself, sort of.
And so then you took the opportunity to play with the long form.
Yeah, yeah. I had written a book. Went to a conference about 12 years ago in Arizona. And Sue Grafton, who was a mystery writer, auctioned off her services as a critic for the
You're
manuscript.
Kidding.
No, it was for Literary Council of whatever town we were in. And I bought it. And she critiqued my manuscript to the tune of like 12 pages, and just said, "This is terrible. What were you thinking? You don't know how to write." And
oh, you're making this up. Mm. She really said that stuff?
She started off by saying, "Have you ever read a novel before?" She has written one. And so then 2 days later, I get a call at my office, and I had told some people about this, and I was very upset. And my secretary said, "It's Sue Grafton on the phone." And I said, "Yeah, right." So I got, I said, "Who is this?" And she said, "This is Sue." She said, "You ready to shoot yourself or shoot me?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "I think you've been extremely rude." I said, "I don't know you, and this seems like just a..." And she said, "You listen to me." She said, "I was going to write a page and say, strengthen your characters, clean up this and clean up that, and good luck." She said, "Instead, I've read something from somebody who really knows how to write, but you made classic mistakes." And she said, "I believe in hitting a horse between the eyes with a 2x4 to get his attention. Did I get yours?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Read my letter, throw your manuscript away, and write another one." And I said, "I don't have time to do that." And she said, "I wrote 5 books before I was published, so don't give me that crap." She said, "Do it." And I said, "What then?" She said, "Send it to me." So I did. 6 months later, I sent it to her, and she called within a week. And she was screaming on the phone, and she said, "You hit a home run. This is it. I'm going to get this sold." And 2 months later, we were in Washington, D.C. at a conference, and she was the master. She was the guest of honor, and she was speaking to 1,800 people. And when she was done, she said, "Before I take questions, I want to introduce Don Bruns and the audience. He's got a manuscript somebody needs to buy." And I looked at my wife, and I thought, wow. And went in the hallway, and Charlie Spicer from St. Martin's Press was there. He said, "Are you the guy?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Do you have the manuscript?" I said, "Yes." He read it on the train back from New York, and he called me 2 weeks later. And
holy cow.
So that's how you sell it.
Yeah, right. That's clearly a way to sell a book.
That
is clearly a way to sell a book. Yeah. And
I don't know how else to do it. That's how you do it. That's how you break into the business.
Yes, at the top.
That was a nice, it was a nice ride, yeah.
My God.
So now I'm writing number 10 right now. So.
And you believe this is what you were meant to do?
No, I don't know. I mean, I believe that, I don't ever believe that people were meant to do. I don't believe that. I believe that you make your own, you know, you pick and choose, and then you work toward that goal. I don't know that it was what I was meant to do.
Well, it certainly fell into place for you in an interesting way. You couldn't have made Sue Grafton appear at that conference, offer her services. No, somebody else might have bought it.
You know, the thing about anything you do in life, Rupert Holmes is a friend of mine, and Rupert Holmes actually is in an anthology I did. I edited him, and he wrote a song for me for this anthology, which has a CD in the back. And Rupert Holmes did the Pina Colada song, and he just finished a play on Broadway with David Hyde Pierce, and he's got 2 Tonys, and he's got 2 Edgars.
And he has a mystery.
Yes, he writes mysteries, and he produced 3 Barbara Streisand albums and gave her material. He's now working on a musical, another Broadway movie musical. Rupert Holmes said to me one time over lunch that people run into him in various places, in the Midwest and other places, and he said, they always say, "You know, how do I make it in this business?" And he said, "You're in Iowa, you're in Kansas, you're in Ohio." He said, "How are you going to make it in this business if you're not where
the business is,
and if you're in the music business?" He said, "It's New York or L.A. And they said, "Well, I can't move there." And he said,
"Well, then you're not going to..."
He said, "When I was pitching songs," he said, "I stood in front of the Brill Building in New York every single day for 6 to 8 hours. And he said, "I had a fistful of songs, and I pigeonholed every single producer, every single record guy who walked up." And he said, "Out of McDormy, but over a period of time, I got the attention of enough people that I sold some songs. And once I started doing that, then it moved to the next level where I actually was able to sell, you know, the Pina Colada thing." And he said, and it goes, and he says, "You have to put yourself in the path of success so that when it goes in, it has to go through you."
That's a great line.
It is. He says, "You have to put yourself in the path so that it can't
miss
do
you.
Anything but go through you." And he said, and that's it. And it's not so much, I think Rupert is fabulously talented. But his thing is, it has nothing to do with the talent, he said, and it had everything to do with putting myself in the path of success. You know, he said, "I knew I could handle it." Most people don't put themselves out
Because they don't know because they know.
Yeah, right. I mean, I would know my limitations if I couldn't carry a tune. I wouldn't try to be a singer, and if I couldn't, you know, put a sentence together, I wouldn't do that. I know I've got. I'm good enough, but I have to put myself, and I'm doing that at the conference. I mean, I'm meeting with a film lady. I'm meeting with a publisher or an editor who's got a manuscript that I want to sell. I go to these conferences because I don't live in New York or L.A., but I try to go to the conferences and I try to meet these people and I network as much as I can because I want to be in the path of success when it comes through.
That's such a great line. You said I want to meet with an editor who has a manuscript I want to sell? What does that mean?
I've got a manuscript.
You have one that you're still looking
to sell.
I did a
manuscript. My agent, see this is the kind of thing you wonder sometimes. Of all the editors and all the agents and all the writers, 3 weeks ago, my agent sent a manuscript that I did. It's different than the I didn't give it to the publisher I'm working with here because it's a different type thing, but he sent it to a guy named Bob Gleason with Tor Forge. And I'm not paying any attention, and yesterday I'm here at the conference and I'm looking, and Bob Gleason is going to talk in the next panel. And he's with Tor Forge, and I'm going, this is coincidental. So I walked up, I introduced myself. He said, I think I've got a manuscript of yours. And I'm thinking, I don't believe he knew that.
Right.
And he did. And he said, I haven't looked at it yet. And he said, I'm going to be gone for 10 days. But he said, when I get back. So then he came up to me a couple times last night and asked me some questions, and we talked today in the elevator a little bit. And, you know, I mean.
Yes.
But I got the manuscript to my agent who is good enough to know Gleason, and then I come to a conference, and Gleason's here, and so it all, you know, you're all hoping it all goes together.
Yeah, but
putting yourself in the path of success.
And then the path of success may actually put itself in your path.
Well, that's what we hope.
Yeah?
We hope.
Well, it does seem to have worked that way for you over and over again.
Yeah, at this point, yeah, I can't complain. It's been good.
No, it's been great.
Yeah.
Okay, so I like to ask, is there anything I didn't ask you? Anything you'd like to say, or anything you'd like to say about what it means to have dedicated a life to various arts, which you certainly have done?
I don't think of that. I mean, I just think I just have fun being creative. I love creative. And you know, the funny thing is about creative people, we found, when we did this anthology, we found that people who write books, there's a number of people who were musical entertainers, mm-hmm. before or after their writing career. And that's what we did. We found 13, had them write a song and a story. I know of dozens of writers who are just obsessed with the kitchen. They love to cook.
To cook and, yeah.
I collect, my wife and I collect paintings by twice gifted artists who are actors, singers, those types who paint. Mm-hmm. We've got original Jimmy Cagney's, wonderful pieces. I got like 8 Jimmy Cagney's. We've got John Lennon. We've got Gary Berghoff, who played Radio Mesh. Charles Bronson. I've got a painting of his that is gorgeous. Phyllis Diller. I've got an original. Donna Summer. A lot of these people. And they're really wonderful pieces. So you find that people who are
creative,
as you
creative.
Said, the arts, but I don't think of the arts so much. I just say creative people tend to
be creative.
Create on a number of levels.
Yes, I think that's true.
It's not that we're good at all of them or any of them, but it's just the fact that there's, you know, they're the accountants and the bean counters and the people who are, you know, the computer geeks, and then there are the people who just bounce off the walls, and I happen to be one of those. So.
Yes. And aren't you lucky?
I don't know.
You
sometimes
don't know?
I don't know. Sometimes it might be better to be a button-down mind kind of a person, but I don't know.
Is that a joke?
No, it's, no, I'm serious. I don't know. I've never been the other. So my father is an engineer. I have a brother who's an engineer. They are very staid, very focused. I have none of that.
Do you know how you happened to come out of that family?
Oh, I have no idea.
Nobody else in the family is a bouncing off the wall kind of person?
No, not really. Mm-mm.
Kind of interesting. Where'd you grow up?
In Ohio.
Right. Mm-hmm. Not exactly a bouncing off the wall kind of place.
No, but it was, you know, there was enough room. I wish I'd gone to New York and stood outside the Brill Building with Rupert, but I didn't, so.
You stood in front of Sue Grafton instead?
Well, I did. And, you know, rather coming to it later in life, but I did that, yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't want to contradict you, but I don't think that's true. I mean, you started right out playing and entertaining and writing, so I don't think you came to it late in life. You just came to this one a little later in life.
That's true.
Anyway, this is absolutely fascinating, and your book, current book, is Bahama Burnout,
mm-hmm.
and who's publishing it?
Ocean View Press.
And Ocean View Press is publishing it, and people can find out about you at www.donbrunsbooks.com. Books.com. D-O-N-B-R-U-N-S books.com. That's, of course, one word.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you very much, Don Bruns.
Thank you, and I appreciate it.
And that was Don Bruns, the multi-talented, absolutely startling mystery writer and everything else. And I have run myself right into the end of this show, so I'm just going to have time to thank Josh Hackney, the wizard who takes care of me, make sure the show is as good as it can be. Any errors do not accrue to him. They all accrue to me. And say, I hope you heard something that interested you, something that got your attention, something that was helpful, something that will bring you back next week, because I will be here next week, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may